Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books. We draw from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Kenneth Schaffner, Distinguished University Professor in the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Pittsburgh. His new book, Behaving, What's Genetic, What's Not, and Why Should We Care, is just out from Oxford University Press. The nature versus nurture debate has evolved into a genes versus environment debate, although it is also widely accepted that what we do, what we are like, and what mental illnesses we have or might be at risk for result from a complex combination of both. In this richly researched book, Schaffner assesses the impact of the enormous strides in recent decades in biology on the genetic contribution to behavior from the sequencing of the human genome and the development of a model organism, the nematode C. elegans, for explaining the relationship between genes and neural function and development. Schaffner considers the methodologies for determining genetic influence and the challenges by developmentalists and others of gene-focused research. He also defends a creeping form of reduction in which multi-level mechanistic explanations are possible in local and specific areas of biology, but which do not support sweeping claims that we are nothing but our genes. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Kenneth Schaffner. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm very eager to be talking with you about your new book, Behaving, What's Genetic, What's Not, and Why Should We Care? And it's a great book that introduces a lot of the important advances in biology, in particular in genetics, over the past few decades, you know, starting with the sequencing of the human genome, the development of the of a model organism for investigating relations between genes and neural function and development, and a lot of other sort of methodological and important scientific advances, as well as the back and forth of, you know, studies claiming one thing about the relation between genes and behavior, and then others not replicating them or having very mixed sorts of research records. So it's a really rich discussion of the recent science and what we can derive, you know, philosophically from these views in terms of, the philosophical discussion about reduction, right? Are we nothing but our genes, or is there a gene for X, you know, versus more as you, the one of the buzzwords these days is the biopsychosocial approach, right, where the environment has a much greater role. So it's a great introduction to all of that. And before we get into the book itself, maybe we can have a little introduction about yourself. You know, how you came to write this book, your own sort of background in both biology or medicine, actually, and philosophy. And then the relation between this book and your previous book, 1993, on discovery and explanation in biology and medicine.
Sure. The discovery and explanation in biology and medicine was started all the way back in roughly 1971. I was impressed with reading Claude Bernard's works and thought that it was really time, since it was very early in the development of anything like a professional philosophy of biology, to try to take a sort of synoptic approach to those kinds of issues. And I was able to happily receive the Guggenheim Grant Fellowship, and between 1973 and 74 began to outline that book. That took many years, filled in the 1970s and the 1980s. The kind of work that I was doing for that led me into medical school. I finished a medical degree in 1986, and then applied what I'd learned from physiology, genetics, immunology, to the issues in philosophy of biology. So the book was finally finished, came out in 1993. And at that point in time, I thought I wanted to go somewhere in a different direction, and thought that though I'd worked a lot on reduction and reductionism, and there's a roughly 100-page chapter in the Discovery and Explanation book on it, I wanted to take it in a different direction. I had already looked a little bit at the neurosciences and at the behavior of a simple organism, the sea snail Aplysia, that Eric Kandel eventually won a Nobel Prize for.
Right.
And started to look a little bit deeper into that, received some National Science Foundation support for it. But then Kandel was kind of distant about wanting to have somebody come to his lab and work on that organism. Happily, at that point in time, I went to a NIH conference on behavior on a variety of organisms. Then simple organisms were beginning to be explored. One of them was the famous fruit fly Drosophila. Another was the mouse. But I was intrigued with the worm, because it looked like the genetics was much more tractable.
Mm-hmm.
And having heard some of the talks by Corey Bargman about this kind of work, decided to turn in that direction. That was roughly 93-94. That led to a target article in Philosophy Science in 98, which in modified form are roughly three of the chapters in the behaving book, and I wanted to carry it on into behavior of humans and psychiatric genetics, which is a closely related field to human behavior genetics. That led to work on DSM-5 with a number of people, including Ken Kendler, who has played a very extraordinarily powerful and important role in the putting together the final form of DSM-5. And so all of that sort of eventually came together in this book, aided by support from NIH and the Hastings Center with a large grant that looked at human behavioral genetics. And the ultimate result was to get this book finished. It had to be redone.
Mm-hmm.
I had a draft completed roughly in 2005 when I returned from George Washington University to the University of Pittsburgh. But at that point in time, the HapMap project was just about finishing up, and they were beginning to identify all of these SNPs, of which we now know, several million. That led to the opportunity to begin to look at the genome-wide association studies. They began to come out in 2007. They really sort of upended the field, and we can talk a little bit more about that in more specific terms a little bit later on. It required rewriting a lot of the book, so it didn't really get accepted until 2013.
Okay, wow. So, and I think all of that really, really shows in the volume, because there's and it's an important attempt to kind of assess, you know, all the amazing advances that have been happening over the past, you know, decade, two decades, three decades, but, you know, more recently, as you mentioned. But maybe we should go back, start from a very, very basic standpoint, which is, it's a book about, as you put it, sort of main themes in behavioral genetics and psychiatric genetics as a sort of a subset of that. And you do talk specifically, which I do when I get to later, personality disorders or personality and the relation between personality and genes, and then schizophrenia and genes. You have two chapters devoted to those particular aspects. But how is behavioral genetics and its subset, psychiatric genetics, how are these related to population genetics?
In a sense, my understanding of population genetics is it is really a kind of way to look at sort of evolutionary implications of genetics. One is, I think, not so much concerned with the phenotypes as it is with the transmission of genetics over various kinds of generations and the fixity of some of those genes on ways they might change. Population genetics, you know, came out of a generalization of Mendelian genetics, you know, to populations and to populations over periods of time. And the, you know, the major players in that area were people like Fisher and then Haldane and Wright, especially. That doesn't really tell us too much about behavior. In fact, there's a kind of a gap between people who work in evolutionary biology and issues involving sort of behavioral genetics and psychiatric genetics. So if one looks at the standard texts in behavioral genetics and in psychiatric genetics, there's relatively little in those texts about evolution, even though there have been disciplines, sociobiology and sort of psychological kinds of genetics, that have tried to bridge those gaps. I think they haven't been, you know, done all that successfully. You know, in part because there are no fossils of behavior that we can go and look, empirically check on things. So I think that the population genetics is an important sort of backdrop, but it doesn't play that much of a role in any of the standard work in psychiatric or behavioral genetics.
Which is sort of interesting, because, you know, one of the background issues, you know, actually that you get to in terms of why should we care about genetics, is this idea that somehow we're determined. You know, I mean, we'll talk about that, but that, you know, somehow we're determined to act in certain ways because of our gene. We're hardwired, as we'll say. And of course, that hardwiring would be a matter of evolution. We're just, you know, we just act this way because that's the way the evolution has formed us to be. So that it's an interesting conceptual gap that, you know, even if these are two sciences that haven't quite, or two approaches within biology that haven't yet really meshed in the sort of popular imagination, when you start talking about genes, the very close relationship between, you know, something being in the genes and something being in the genes because that's the way we evolved, are, you know, these things are almost inseparable. You start with the concept of heritability, and this is a very, you know, central concept to behavioral genetics, but it's one that, as you point out, is very easy to confuse. So just to give an example that came to my mind immediately was, you know, we have, you know, all humans have, you know, genetically an opposable thumb. And yet, having an opposable thumb has zero heritability. And so, and in contrast, you mentioned schizophrenia. The risk for developing that is about the heritability is about well, the risk is accounted for approximately 48% or so by the genes. And so could you explain a bit, explain the notion of heritability and why it's so important in these studies?
I think of one of the problems with heritability is that, just as you pointed out using that example, is that it sort of plays tricks with the mind, leads to inappropriate kinds of inferences. I think one way to think about it is that what heritability does is it accounts for individual differences, in effect in a population, but as accounting for the variation that one sees in that population for a particular kind of a phenotype. That phenotype can be something as more or less benign as, say, height. You know, we might come back to that later, or fingerprint similarity. And also, as more controversial, it's been discussed extensively in the history of the literature, cognitive capacities like IQ, but as well as other kinds of disorders like schizophrenia and depression. So what does the heritability do? It gives you a very kind of a gross pointer to where you think the genes might be accounting for the variation that we see for that phenotype in that population. On the other hand, the heritability doesn't indicate anything about the specific ways that the genes work or what genes there are. It is a very kind of a gross parameter that suggests that perhaps if heritability is reasonably high, then to account for the differences that we see between people who have a disorder or have a particular phenotype versus those that don't is to look at those kinds of features that are relatively high in heritability. And so in schizophrenia, and in, say, height, we do think that heritability runs something like 80%. I sometimes like to think of those kinds of relationships in somewhat different ways. As, you know, what is the risk if one has an identical twin? What is the likelihood that one would develop that particular trait or that particular disorder? And that might give us a little bit of a better handle on same kind of issues that heritability tries to get a handle on. The other problem with heritability has been pointed out by philosopher biologists like Lewontin and others, is that you really have to pay attention to the environment, because heritability is contingent on environments. And that's part of the formal definition, and it's part of the conceptual definition, so that whether or not something is, quote, genetic, unquote, and the extent to which it's malleable or changeable is going to depend upon the nature of the environment that one is in. So that's the reason, you know, carefully about it, not to overemphasize, you know, what comes out of it, not to confuse it with unchangeability, and not to confuse it with changes in environment that might significantly change that heritability.
Yeah, so that's an important point, because I mean, do you think the concept is a helpful one outside of its very specific context? I mean, one of the points you make in the book at some point is that, you know, high heritability is not related to, you know, finding a specific underlying gene or even just a few of them, and it is contingent, as you just mentioned, on the environment, and all of this. That's not that nuanced. So I sort of wonder, is the concept itself a helpful one for helping lay people outside of the specific context of biology, helping them understand the relationship between genes and behavior?
I think it may be more misleading than it actually is actually helpful. I think it's helpful for the professional investigators to perhaps plan their research programs and to look for genetic aspects that might relate to the particular kind of trait that they're interested in. But just a very brief anecdote. There was a famous or perhaps infamous meeting at the University of Maryland back in 1995 on genes and crime. This was supported by the National Institutes of Health with a research grant, and it led to actually being invaded by groups of people who were opposed to that kind of a research program involving fist fights, and police were called to break up the conference temporarily. But at that conference, there were very prominent speakers. I attended to essentially talk about the worm, but there were people talking about heritability and crime. And one of the major investigators said that it really is inappropriate to talk about heritability, that it's misleading in this context. And then, of course, after saying that, his next slide was a long list of heritabilities for particular traits related to genes and crime. Uh-huh. It's almost as if they recognize the problems, but they can't stop talking about it.
Okay. Yeah, it is too bad, because I don't think things have improved since then, from what I can tell.
No, I think it's still somewhat misleading. And one of the areas that we might get to towards the end of our discussion, I did not do too much with IQ and race in this book, but a sequel book will address some of those issues. And that's where there was a lot of fractious discussion, at least twice in the history of this discipline. You know, first coming out from some of the work by Arthur Jensen back in 1969, 1970, and then with the Bell Curve book, which came out in 1984. Right. But again, in a sense, confusing what the implications were of these various studies and what the implications were for ethnic differences. So I think it's still a set of issues, and I suspect we'll continue to see it, you know, yet again.
One of the critical points that you make throughout the book is the idea that, you know, the relations between genes and phenotypes, or, you know, behavior at the organism level, or personality traits, things like that. It's very complicated, and you develop what you summarize as what you call 8 rules. I mean, they're not laws or anything like that, but they're sort of regularities or something. Even that word philosophically is a little bit, maybe a bit too strong, but you use the word rules, and these are rules for causal relationships between genes and behavior and various steps therein. So, for example, one rule is that you often have many genes that are causally related to the development of a particular of one neuron. One neuron can be causally related to many behaviors. You have different environments and histories which are related to different ways of gene expression, which are related causally to different behaviors. So you have a sort of a framework of 8 different rules for the relationships between, say, genes, neurons, behavior, environment. Can you say something, you know, explain a bit about those rules and how they complicate, you know, how the gene for X picture has kind of just basically been just blown up for many, if not all, phenotypes?
Yeah, I think that there's probably at least 2 aspects to that kind of an answer. Those rules were, in a sense, inductively generated from a deep and long analysis of the worm C. elegans. What I wanted to do was to see exactly in an organism that we know, you know, how many genes there are, and we know an awful lot about the circuits of that organism. It was the organism that Sidney Brainerd chose to begin to investigate, the simplest organism he could find that had a nervous system, how genes might relate to behaviors. And I was lucky enough to be introduced to Corey Bargman. Corey is the co-director of Obama's Brain research program, and she has been an investigator in that area since, I think, the late 80s until now. I took some of her papers and then read a number of other papers, looking for what were those relationships between genes and behaviors. And I found that one of the first points she made was that genes don't affect the behaviors directly. They work through neural systems. And that was, in a sense, the beginning of looking for what were some of the generalities that would capture some of the complexity of the relationships between genes and behavior. And out of the literature and a variety of different kinds of experimental preparations and such, I tried to distill what amounted to roughly eight generalizations. They weren't, too deep, but they seemed to, when they were put together, capture some of the complexity of those relationships. And one of the reviewers of the philosophy science paper where I first introduced those rules said, well, aren't these obvious? And they weren't that obvious at the time. And in fact, Corey Bargerman had thought that as one drilled down into this organism, one would find a relationship that could be characterized as one gene, one type of behavior. And in fact, the story that I tell in the book about some of Bargerman's work and de Bono's work, they thought that they found in one gene, this NPR1 gene, a switch that would change the eating behavior of C. elegans from eating in a solitary way in a petri dish to eating in clumps on a petri dish. Mm-hmm. It's turned out, I think, that she's probably modified her views so that she's now quite attuned to the complexity that one finds. So those rules were an attempt to generalize from these experiments to show some of the complexity.
The overall take-home messages that I got from the book is just how complex it is and how, we really, for the most part, and even in kind of the best of cases, like maybe Huntington's disease or something where you can identify a particular locus, the environment and there are different, there's the in utero environment, there's, the outside of the, the self, the person environment. I mean, the complexity there is so great that to even talk about a gene for X, the question, the real question, as far as I could tell, was not so much, been there, done that, shouldn't do it anymore, but what can we come up with to replace that rule, gene for X, with other rules that will give us a better picture of what's really going on. I sort of saw your eight rules as a move in that direction.
Now, remember that those eight rules came out of investigating the C. elegans organism. It's got, in effect, 302 neurons, 5,000 synapses, roughly 1,000 genes. So it's quite simple. Now, the other answer to the issue of complexity and rules is that when I wrote that set of papers in the original form, this was pre-GWAS, and there was still hope.
GWAS being the genome-wide
association studies work really didn't begin to come out until roughly 2006, 2007. And, that, in a sense, is the second part of the complexity source. So when people began to look at other kinds of disorders, initially they thought there'd be some dominant genes in schizophrenia and some dominant genes in, say, Alzheimer's disorder affecting memory and such. Now, some of that is still the case. One of the most interesting, very recent developments in the Alzheimer's area is in DSM-5, this 2013 most recent version of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Psychiatric Disorders. That is, I think, one of the first examples of a disorder that is now diagnosable by using a particular set of genes. There are some early onset genes that I mentioned briefly in my discussion about Alzheimer's in the book. But at that point in time that I finished the book, DSM-5 5 hadn't really come out in its final form. But now you can actually diagnose a person as having Alzheimer's if they have some of these, there's 3 roughly dominant genes that affect people with Alzheimer's in their 50s. So there's still, you know, occasionally something like one gene, one disorder example. It's like the Huntington's thing. But that pales against many other diseases. Now, in the area, for example, of schizophrenia and also personality genetics, what GWAS has shown is that there are hundreds of genes, maybe even 1,000 genes that might affect schizophrenia, coming in different packages and working in different ways. And that's where the field is sort of beginning to focus on that, and also on environmental factors, on immunological interactions with the genetics of schizophrenia. The second set of arguments is that what the GWAS revolution has done is to show that there are many, many, many genes that affect in very complicated ways these various kinds of traits and disorder. And the same thing holds true for height. You know, I looked up the most recent publication, I think from 2014 in Nature, said that they had identified 700 genes, or at least 700 SNPs that were fairly closely related to genes, all of which had very small effects on height. And this was done in a population of some 30,000 individuals. So there's many ways to tell the tale about complexity. And some of it comes out of simple organism work, but some of it now comes out of this GWAS and GCTA genome complex trait analysis approaches to disorders.
Can you give us a brief explanation of how the genome-wide association studies go?
Essentially, the best way to think of it is that what was needed was the genome project, the Human Genome Project, that was started roughly back about 1990, to sequence the entire genome, is the backdrop to that. But they had to do another analysis. They had to look at also variation across individuals. And they had to do, sequencing of these 3 billion base pairs. What they found doing the analysis of one of the strands, the haploid account, sometimes it's called the HapMap, it was that there were millions of different variations, single nucleotide polymorphisms. That's abbreviation of that is SNPs. These are, simple mutations like a thymine for an adenine that often don't make any difference to what's going on in a particular individual. Mm-hmm. But they're good markers. So if you can identify them and you find that they're reasonably common in large populations, then you can use those as ways to begin to map differences between individuals, and therefore look for things that might be associated, like interesting phenotypes that might be studied, associated with variations of a million different kinds of variations. Now the SNPs themselves are not genes; they're essentially loci. They, in effect, are genes, but they're not genes that are known to be causative. But they're good maps. And as a result of having that map, one can do these association studies where you can look at, what's the picture given the maps of, a population of people that have schizophrenia versus those that don't, and see, where things begin to point to the differences. Now, what that amounts to is you're looking across all of the chromosomes at least, say, now a million differences. And that means that you're testing hypotheses that are multiple hypotheses. So as a result of doing those kinds of studies, they have to do all sorts of statistical corrections, which means, if you remember your statistics, that you need very large numbers of people. Mm-hmm. Because of all the hypotheses that are being, checked. So, they now talk about looking at 50,000 twin pairs in order to look at some of these variations, across these genome-wide analyses. It has really begun to revolutionize a wide variety of genetic studies, not in the behavioral area only. I mean, there's been very important discoveries about macular degeneration and Crohn's disease, and also diabetes, type 1 and type 2, are using these new kinds of methodologies. But they do require enormously large groups of people.
So one of the things that you you just mentioned, that in the latest paper you saw something like 700 genes in some way that make some small, tiny contribution to height, or at least to, I should probably say more specifically, to explaining the heritability of height. You raised the issue of what you call the missing heritability problem, or what people in the field call the missing heritability problem, which is nicely illustrated by the case of height. Can you explain that, since it seems to play a pretty important
role? Those 700 SNPs.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
They're closely related to genes, and you can, you know, sort of think through, you know, what affects height. You know, it's everything from bone structure to muscle structure to general health and such. So turns out that height is roughly close to 90% heritable. That is, you know, identical twins are going to be pretty close in terms of their resemblance on issues involving height. One of the interesting things about missing heritability is that the gold standard is really the use of sort of the older twin studies that, you know, have estimated what heritability should be, taking those as reasonably definitive. We talked before about schizophrenia as having heritability of around 80%. And then the question is, what will we find out from the GWAS studies and those genes or the SNPs that have been found that seem to account for some of the heritability? Those 700 genes or SNPs account for only about 20% of the differences in height. So you've got, still something like 60 to 70% of the variation that we don't know, you know, where it's coming from. And that's the missing heritability. The idea that I think the investigators have is that this is accounted for by other SNPs, other genes that have such low signals, that is such low effect, that we'll have to get even larger studies in order to begin to reveal what those are. And until that can be done, there's this gap between the heritability that's estimated by using the traditional types of twin studies versus the heritability that can be accounted for by using the GWAS studies. And even in GWAS, as we've already, I think, indicated, we don't really know in most cases what those genes are. We just have some suggestions as to what they might be and what they might be doing.
One of the main critiques, you might say, of the, you know, the focus on genes has been the what you call the developmentalist challenge. Maybe you can give us a sense of what that position is. You divide it into several different types of what you call the seven deadly sins of causation and the four major mistakes of classical approaches to the problem of nature versus nurture. Could you say something about the developmentalist challenge?
Yeah, that, in a sense, came out of the work that I was doing with C. elegans. I had encountered, when I started doing the investigation of behavioral genetics, criticisms that people like Lewontin, and then some of the work that came out of Ayama, Susan Ayama's work, Paul Griffith's work, suggesting that there was an over attention to sort of genocentrism, that it was the genes that were accounting for various kinds of differences in the behavioral area. So what I had done was to go through a number of the criticisms of simple forms of gene behavior relationships and tried to identify what were some of the themes and the general ideas that the critics of behavioral genetics were utilizing. And I sort of extracted from that, as you say, sort of seven deadly sins. These are sins that the developmentalists alleged were being committed by the people that were sort of genetic determinists and oversimplified genetics. So they would say that genes are a blueprint for the organism. That would be, say, one example of one of the sins. And sins or mistakes, these amount to contrast between what the developmentalists thought were more accurate ways of describing the complexity versus the oversimplified accounts that were being used by many of the investigators that were doing behavioral genetics at the time. So I identified roughly, you know, about 11 of those general ideas. And then, you know, there were things like one gene causes one behavior, that the DNA sequences contain the essences of behavioral information. Those were those sins of the mistakes were things like empirical studies can easily disentangle the effects of heredity and environment into specific percentages. I analyzed those in the context of the C. elegans research projects, and then out of that extracted what I thought were roughly sort of five general ideas that seemed to be the core of the objections. And it had to do with, you know, are genes really special, or are they just one of another kind of causal roles? Can you actually disentangle the environment and the genes? Can you make any kinds of predictions that might be involved? So those developmentalists, I thought they were very appropriate challenges to the simplified forms that some of the behavior geneticists were pursuing. But I thought that the developmentalists tend to overreact and to overly criticize. And I thought that some of their ideas were quite right, and others were a little bit too strong. Lewontin, for example, thought that, you know, you could never get predictions of behavior because of the complexity. There were behavior was in some sense emergent from the various kinds of gene interactions. And so I split a difference. Paul Griffiths was a commentator on the first version of those papers that were in Philosophy of Science back in 1998. And Griffiths anointed me as a developmentalist. I think that that's a little bit too strong. I accepted some of their theses and modified some of their other theses. So, that was the challenge. I welcomed the challenge. I tried to sort of pick and choose what I thought were valid accounts that they were giving and criticize some of the other accounts. And in a sense, we still go on and do that. As you, I think, know, Paul Griffiths and Carolus Statz has you know, produced a book on genetics and philosophy, and they are still you know, pursuing something like the developmentalist challenge in the context of contemporary work.
Yeah, I think the genocentrism is that's a good sort of word to capture the general tenor, I would say, of the discussion. I mean, you still maintain that genes, although you do take on board some of the points from the developmentalists and disagree to some extent with others, you still say that genes have a sort of first among equals role for both epistemic and heuristic reasons in terms of explaining behavior.
I think
could you explain that position? I mean, and defend it.
It's a position that is still, I think, argued back and forth in the philosophy of biology area. And one of the writers who's still defending, in a sense, an even stronger form of genocentrism is Ken Waters. Mm-hmm. He seems to think that the that genes have some kind of an ontological priority in accounting for various kinds of traits, and that they are, in a very strong sense, ontologically the explainers of various kinds of phenotypes. I see the genes, in a network manner, and I see them as particularly heuristically important because they're simpler than, say, what we can understand about proteins and protein interactions. They're a lot simpler than environmental interactions, on a developing organism. We have some pretty good, what I would call, general theories of the gene. And, that comes to us from Mendel and Morgan through Watson and Crick. We know how the genes work. We know what they are. We know, in a sense, how they interact. We can, in a sense, look at a linear molecule like DNA and make important predictions. There is a genetic code. Genes are sort of key ways that we can interact with organisms, and we can classify organisms by using genes and by using the DNA sequences and such. So I think that there are some very powerful tools that are involved there. But at the same time, genes don't act, on their own. They come, to us in cells. They come to us with proteins. Cells reproduce. Genes themselves purely don't reproduce, except in very special circumstances, in test tubes. And that in order to account for anything like life and for various kinds of properties developing, we have to take into account other factors in the system. The developmentalists have tended to say, they're, all of those factors are on a par. I think that epistemically and heuristically, the genes still have a bit more going for them. And that's, the position that I've tried to sketch. I summarized some of Waters' arguments in, I think it was chapter 8 of the book, criticized some of them, partly from a developmentalist point of view, pointing out that sometimes it's the environments which are the key switches that are involved even in things like C. elegans, and that it often depends upon the context, the kinds of questions that one is trying to direct one's attention to.
Okay, so that, I mean, that sounds a bit more ecumenical, I would say, than at least many in that camp might want to endorse. In a sense, I mean, there seems to be a difference between the role that genes can play because of their relative simplicity, given our where we're at now in terms of knowledge, and the role that they actually sort of do play in terms of explaining our behavior. I guess I'm trying to assess just how deep the commitment to a more, to the gene is. I mean, you're not going as far as Waters, but you're sort of not quite being in the developmentalist camp. Do you see that as, well, that's just because that's where we are right now in terms of the history of biology in a way? But it's nothing, it's not deeper than that. And for all we know, in the future, when we finally get our eyes off from just the genes and we look at the environment more closely and direct more research time and money and to the environment, it could turn out that, the genes are important, but, it's no more justified in the end to focus on them as, the first among equals than it would be, to focus on the spark plugs, because that's what we have more access to.
I think that's part of the issue. Part of it has to do with the, as I mentioned before, we have a pretty good set of theories about how genes work. It's harder to understand exactly how the environment affects the development of cells and multicellular organisms and such. I've been looking recently, a kind of an offshoot project related to the sense comparison between what we can learn about cancer and its genetics and the role of the environment and where there could be various kinds of factors that are involved. And also a relationship that comes out of behavioral genetics. So it turns out that the GWAS studies of schizophrenia have identified as one of the strongest areas in the genetics is something that's called the mixed histocompatibility complex. These are the areas in the genome that affect the immune system. So that's where the strongest signal is coming out of the GWAS results. So people are wondering, you know, what is it about the immune system that affects schizophrenia? And the answers aren't in yet, but we do know from cancer work that cancers will develop depending on what happens in the utero environment and the kinds of infections that mothers have when they are pregnant with a fetus. And it looks like there are very important sort of developmental interactions between the immunological system and the system which affects the development of the brain, as well as immunological interactions with cancer. So I think that we have to learn a lot more about these other systems and the way they interact. In a sense, it is the biopsychosocial kind of model. Mm-hmm. But as illustrated in terms of something like interactions between the immune system, the neural system, and even the endocrine system.
So let me just ask you about reduction. I mean, that's one of the critical philosophical positions that you talk about as a result of looking at all the recent work in genetic behavioral genetics and psychiatric genetics. What is your view of reduction? I mean, you divide sort of sweeping reduction, the more historical Nagelian type thing, from what you call your creeping reductions, which seem in essence to be sort of local, small, local, multi-level mechanistic explanations. Can you explain your position on reduction?
Yeah, let me step back a little bit in history. Mm-hmm. When I first started looking at the issue of reduction, it was, I think, when I was a first-year graduate student at Columbia, and I talked with Ernest Nagel about what I might think about writing a dissertation on, even though the dissertation was several years further down the road. And he had suggested that there were a couple of very interesting papers that had come out from the work of Paul Feyerabend, mm-hmm. critical of some work that Nagel had done on theory reduction. Nagel's example was the explanation of thermodynamics by statistical mechanics. And he said that Feyerabend had been very critical of him. And by the way, there was a book that would be soon coming out. This is 1961. Mm-hmm. That would support something like what Feyerabend was after. And it was by a physicist named Thomas Kuhn, was going to produce a book that wasn't yet out on the structure of scientific revolutions that would make some similar kinds of points. So I began to look at relationships in reduction in physics and in chemistry and in biology. And in the early stages, it looked like something like a modified form of the Nagel model would work fairly well in physics. And I published an article in the Journal of Philosophy in 2012 in which I showed how far one could explain something like optics by electromagnetic theory using something like a modified form of Nagelian reduction. But that seems to work pretty well in physics, because in physics we can actualize theories. The theories are in some sense simplified. You can interrelate them in nice ways. You get what's called theory reduction. That doesn't work in biology. And it became pretty clear to me in the 1970s that we just didn't have theories like that in biology. What we had were all of these sort of complicated models. Some people now like to call them mechanisms. And they work in various areas, but they don't extend very broadly. So when I looked at some of the best examples of an explanation of some biological phenomena in terms of the underlying chemistry, the first example that I looked at was the operon model that Jacob and Minot had developed. And there it seems to, you know, work nicely, but it only works easily in E. coli. You can get some explanations of some things there, but you can't extend them easily. It took biology many, many years to begin to see how it worked in eukaryotic organisms, how much more complicated accounts, you know, began to develop that related genes and various kinds of phenotypes. And it seemed to me that what you were beginning to get was something like patchy reductions, partial reductions, interlevel reductions in biology that you didn't get in physics when you could do your work there. So I still think that's the case. We can, given the complexity of biology and the variation that evolution has produced, we can get some nice areas where we can explain some things, but they don't really amount to anything like a general theory of the behavior of the organism. So that's that would be a sweeping theory. And there are some philosophers, I think the Churchlands still defend something like the possibility of sweeping reductions. I think that Dan Dennett has called those greedy reductions. I tend to think of the reductions that we get as being partial and local. And that's what I continue to see in the area of behavioral genetics.
So how local exactly? I mean, you just mentioned the lack operon model for E. coli, and you said, you know, the original Jacob Monod model worked for, you know, that particular organism, you know, that particular mechanism, but it didn't extend that easily. So how local are these mechanistic explanations, or these local, you know, little small reductions?
I think, you know, even if you look at something like E. coli, and if you you look at what's going on in terms of phage and phage lambda, that the systems that you describe there are quite different. There's similarities, but they're not identities between what you get in different operons. In fact, I think one biologist referred to the types of operons that one found in just E. coli as a panoply of operons, some involving positive regulation, some involving like lack negative regulation and such. So the sweep and the scope, you can't take one simple model and say it applies in a wide variety of circumstances. You have to keep sort of modifying them and changing them. I think we'll see that in something like schizophrenia genetics. I think there'll be lots of different kinds of schizophrenia where there's some type that's related to some set of genetic mutations and environmental insults. And there'll be other forms of the schizophrenia that are related to different pathways, different genes. So they will tend to be local. That'll be a problem for treatment. One will, in some sense, have to identify the different points where one can do the interventions, and I think they will differ.
Okay, so I mean, you also mentioned the Churchlands, and yeah, they've at least in the past, of course, in terms of cognition, you know, the reductionist proclivities were pretty clear. An issue that comes up in that particular context more than maybe generally in philosophy biology is the whole idea of multiple realization or multiple realizability. You know, the idea that the same function can be subserved by many different sorts of mechanisms or explanations or structures. How does your view of reduction have anything to say about that particular debate that's often connected to debates about reduction?
I think that multiple realizability, I guess, could have strong forms and weaker forms. Mm-hmm. I think that in terms of, say, specific forms of something like a disorder like schizophrenia, that, you know, there will be different ways in which you'll have a sort of a common endpoint and different routes that will, you know, end up at that sort of common endpoint. We still don't know enough about what those pathways are. We might have a better handle on how those pathways might work in, say, something like Alzheimer's disease. But even there, you know, the field is still uncertain in, say, Alzheimer's. Is it the plaques that are, you know, being produced that result in the neurological damage? Or is it the tangles that come out of, you know, the tau factors that produce mm-hmm. that end result? Or are there, you know, two forms that are involved? You know, going back to, say, diabetes, there's a very different pathophysiology for juvenile diabetes, you know, versus adult onset diabetes. The interventions that one takes are, you know, generally quite different. It was required to, even though it looked like, you know, diabetes might be realized by one common kind of pathway or mechanism, it turned out that, you know, it diverged. Mm-hmm. There was an insult to the pancreas through autoimmune factors in the juvenile diabetes that can only be treated with insulin, whereas in the adult form of diabetes, the pathway was realized in terms of insulin resistance. You know, that could be overcome by different ways of dealing with it. So, yeah, I think there'll be multiple realizability. I don't think it's necessarily going to turn out to be intractable, though there are some people in the behavioral genetics area, like Eric Turkheimer, with whom I've worked quite a bit, who think that the complexity is going to be so great that there'll be multiple realizabilities, and we really are not going to be able to, you know, tease out a small number of these relatively common pathways.
Mm-hmm.
So I think of it as an empirical issue.
Yeah.
Not necessarily intractable, you know, as of yet.
There's so much that we haven't had a chance to talk about, which is kind of what I suspected when we started, because there is so much in the book to discuss. Is there some final word you would like to say about the book before we end our conversation?
No, I think the book is doing well. The first printing sold out, but they're in the process of reprinting it, so it should be available again. It's now come out in both a Kindle book and a Nook book as well. So there is a lot in the book. It's a complicated story with many facets and such. I think that readers of the book could, you know, look at one of the early chapters, introduction, gives a kind of an overview, and the end chapter, I think it's chapter 9, gives a pretty good detailed summary of where the book has gone. And I think, you know, even though there's a lot of complexity and detail, people can then, you know, go and read those portions of things that they, you know, would want to delve into in more depth. The problem with the field is that it's still evolving.
Right.
Don't have a really good handle on personality genetics at all. And, you know, they're having to go back and start from square one with sort of GWAS analysis. They thought they had a breakthrough in terms of certain traits from the Caspian-Moffat work. And then a lot of that has, I think, evaporated in the light of genome-wide analyses. So it's a field which is still, you know, evolving and further forming. But I think the book can give you an orientation. We're able to get a really nice index so that one can, you know, track back to look at those things that are of special interest to me.
Last question, what's on your horizon next? I mean, you have another book planned or just some articles, same topic, different topics?
I do have another book. So the first book in this area is called Behaving, and the second book is going to be called Choosing. And what I want to look at are the influences that genetics may have, behavioral genetics might have, on choosing and choice and living a good life. And for doing that, that's given me a chance to go back and look at issues involving cognitive capacity and on restrictions involving choice, a much deeper analysis of so-called free will kinds of issues, as well as impulse control what might make a life worth living that could be potentially affected by genetics. So that's the next project. I've already started on it, and I will be working on it for the next few years.
Excellent. I look forward to seeing that for sure. But we are now out of time, so I just want to say thank you again for joining us. It's been a very interesting, wide-ranging conversation, and I wish you luck with the next book.
Well, thank you, and thank you for inviting
me. You've been listening to my interview with Kenneth Schaffner, Distinguished University Professor in the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Pittsburgh. We've been talking about his new book, Behaving, What's Genetic, What's Not, and Why Should We Care?, which is just out from Oxford University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.